Hey everyone, before we move into today's episode, I just want to wish Happy Diwali and Halloween to all of you. We have celebrated it last night in UK, and if you are behind us, then enjoy the time tonight and have fun with your family. If you have celebrated it already, then I hope you had an amazing time. Now let's move on to the main episode.
Get Certified Together program is created by TechnoCofe, your free online knowledge sharing website, based out in London.
So from the CSP point of view, scope is quite limited, and what they really have to make sure is all the official documentation, including the contract which has been signed with the customer, must be pretty clear. Like, it must have clear designation and clear segregation where the roles and responsibilities of a cloud service provider ends and from where the consumers or customers' responsibilities start. Because for example, if there is a risk associated,
how do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today is actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.
Everyone, welcome to another episode of Get Certified Together series. This is episode number 50 I'm recording today, and I never had thought when I started this series that episode number 50 will be the last episode of the CCSP series. When we started with CompTIA. We ran that session for around 16 or 17 episodes. Then we have a couple of introductions and discussions around how the exam went and some interviews. Then we moved on to CCSP series. At that time, it was not even in my distant dream that I will be reaching 50 episodes. Moreover, 50th episode will be the last episode where we will be covering the few remaining topics of the CCSP. But before moving into the main episode where we will be covering all those remaining topics, I want to share the big news. I have actually registered for the exam. So my examination is in December. I was planning to make it around mid of December, but then I realized I have some family commitments around that. Of course, after mid of December will be all Christmas holidays. I never tried, but for sure I would not be getting any slots around that timing because this is not a remotely proctored exam. I have to go into the center to give the exam. So for sure those centers would be closed around the Christmas period and everything. My target was to wrap it up in this year itself. So of course I don't want to plan it for first half of the 2025. So that's it, means that's why I planned it in the first half of December. It's less than 2 months now, around 1 month and maybe around 2 or 3 weeks more before I will be sitting for my first attempt for the examination. So as expected, means I am doing both revision as well as looking into those practice papers and sample papers simultaneously. So I'm looking into like examination, what kind of questions will be coming in the exam, doing different level of readings from multiple sources. Even I have joined the CCSP IC2 official study group as well. People are sharing their recently, if someone have taken the exam, how it went and what kind of environment will be there, what kind of questions you can expect, means not really the questions but around what topics and how to prepare for the examination. So I am in that mood now where I have to finally take the exam and wrap it up and finish it off. So that was the whole idea behind the series as well. instead of getting myself certified and then telling everyone like, this is how you are supposed to do and this is how what you have not to do. I started this series with a mindset that this is the examination which I have to take. I'll be doing study, and instead of studying myself and doing all the research work and keeping the knowledge with me, why not I share my journey with you guys and finally take the examination. And I'm not really sure, maybe I can like pass, or even if there is a failure written there, then everything will be transparent and everything will be in front of you. And if I somehow is not able to make it, then I will be sharing like what I did wrong and what things you can avoid when you will be sitting the exam by yourself. So that's the whole point, and I just wanted to share with you about that particular information. Now, if you want to see like how registration process work and what I did for registering myself for the examination, it's pretty simple. Means by now you must be a member of ISC2. If not, then you can register for the exam. You can register. If you open the portal of ISC2, I'll put the link in the show notes as well. If you open that portal, in right top corner, there's a nice option of registering for the exam. You have to select like which exam you want to go for, fill in all your details, and then they will be transferring you to Pearson View official website. If you haven't taken any Pearson Views exam before via them, then you have to create a new account. If it's an existing account, then you have to log in into that. You will be getting like, again, you have to select the examination which you are planning to take. Once you select that examination, then you have to choose the date, time slot and everything. And of course, in the last page of the exam, you have to pay the fee as well. For me, it cost around £570. But if based on the currency in which you are based at, the amount may go up or down. So it will be according to the currency in which you are paying in. So once you pay the examination, you will get a nice confirmation mail that yes, we received your money and you are all good to take the examination. Make sure they bring identification or something. So this is because I have already taken one of the examination from ISC2 before. I remember that you have to take an ID proof or something, which will show like I am the right person who is taking the examination and everything. So that's all you have to sort out. And once you book your slot and book your examination, I think then you will be in the same phase as mine, like do the revision, take as many practice question papers as you can, try to get hold of whatever information from wherever you can, and of course be in the mindset or be in that kind of mood that this is the final lap of your race and finally the goal which you wanted to achieve after starting CCSP journey. It's almost there. Means you have to do that last lap or last leap as fast as you can and give your best. And I think if we have covered everything, if we have revised everything, I don't know. I mean, I would be pretty confident for all of us that we can do the examination and we can pass it with the required marks and everything. But if something goes wrong, even if like even for myself, I'm not able to make it, then for me, for anyone else as well, that's just a part of journey. Means I have failed a lot of certification exams in my career, and I know that feeling that when you fail an exam, you feel like this is like end of the world or something, because and it's worst when you see other people and other members who are getting clearing those exam, and then you are the one who is failing one of that. And means for me, when I was starting the cloud journey, the very associate level of my organization's internal exam, I failed that. Means it was like at that particular moment I thought that cloud is even not made for me. Means I'm not made for cloud, or cloud is not made for me. I don't know which way around it is, but yeah, anyhow, means I thought that yeah, that's it, means cloud is gone. I'm not going for another set of like reattempt on that examination, and for sure I'm not making my career in the cloud. Well, today I'm a cloud architect and I am taking a cloud security examination, which is again a new thing for me, but of course I'm going with the same mindset that it's okay, even if I fail, I have to still continue the journey. So that's it from the introduction point of view and the information which I wanted to share before we move into our main episode. So before moving into main episode, I we'll take a quick short break, and once we are back from break, we can wrap it up, finish all those remaining topics of domain.
How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today is actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com. Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.
Six. All right, welcome back. Before we move into the rest of episode, let me quickly tell you guys what all subtopics are remaining, because it's been a long time and I'm sure we all just have this tendency to just ignore the syllabus as we start studying, or if there is a gap of some sort of. So even I have to revisit all of my previous episodes, at least like last 4 or 5 ones, to understand what I have covered till now and what really is pending as part of CCSP course. So one of them is understanding implication of cloud to enterprise risk management. Another one is outsourcing and cloud contract design. So these two are the last subtopics of the syllabus, and you can clearly see in the, if you have that documentation as well, the whole course and what subtopics are into individual domain. So we are only pending with these. Some topics or some information around these two is already been covered before. So if I'm being honest with you, things like risk treatment, how we can avoid or how we can transfer the risk, who is data owner or controller, what is the roles and responsibilities between data custodian and different data owners. In fact, about contracting as well, SLAs, some of the bits we have already covered. So in a way, it will be more kind of refresher for those topics or those informations. But anyhow, because they are covered as a separate subtopic in the official course, so we have to cover it, and that's what we will be doing today. Let me quickly open my notes first. Okay, to start with cloud risk management. Now, we will start with the CSP side of things, like CSP side of risk management controls and procedure. If you remember from the cloud basics, there is a cloud service provider and there is an entity called customer. We also have some entities called third parties, which are involved somehow in managing the infrastructure or deploying some services onto the cloud for a customer. But as a starter, we will only be talking about from the CSP side of risks, because as a cloud service provider, you are owner of some of the infrastructure. You are still maintaining a data center, which you are selling as a business. So whenever there is a business or whenever there is some level of technology involved, you of course have associated risks as well. So from the CSP point of view, what are those kind of risks and what kind of controls and methodologies we can use? Now, of course, from the CSP point of view, if you are a cloud service provider, you have some level of leeway in terms of like what are risks associated with you, because ultimately what you are providing is you are just providing the infrastructure. You are just providing a physical hardware, which is no one is aware of. As a consumer, they are not aware of what kind of infrastructure is used on the real data center in backend. So from the CSP point of view, scope is quite limited. And what they really have to make sure is all the official documentation, including the contract which has been signed with the customer, must be pretty clear. Like it must have clear designation and clear segregation where the roles and responsibilities of a cloud service provider ends and from where the consumers or customers' responsibilities start. Because for example, if there is a risk associated with the virtual machine, or with the maybe older version of operating system on the virtual machine, or using a containerized image which is having a pretty old code, or it's not checked regularly for all the vulnerabilities in its SBOM. It's not at all, the risk is on the shoulders of cloud service provider. It's on the ownership of customers. So from the provider's point of view, controls and policies are pretty clear and pretty limited as well, because ultimately what they are providing is they are just providing infrastructure. Now, of course, if a cloud service provider is providing a SaaS application, for example, if you are using AWS Workspaces, which are a Windows remote desktop solutions provided by AWS, Azure has something similar. They provide Azure virtual desktops. Now, these are Windows machines which are running on AWS or Azure infrastructure, and end users are getting a nice remote interface, a remote virtual machine with Windows and everything, kind of your laptop, but you are not managing that laptop. You are just getting a nice interface of Windows. Now, everything around, for example, the patching of that operating system, what kind of administrator rights are there, what kind of processes are running as whenever that workspace or whenever that remote virtual desktop boots up, everything is controlled by AWS, and AWS have to ensure that they have all the policies in place. So those are like SaaS application. Similarly, we have OneDrive, we have Gmail, where you are completely unaware as an end user what's going on in the application, but everything is as the onus is on the cloud service or application service provider. So based on that, of course, the risk appetite change as well. If a cloud service provider is only providing infrastructure, its risk appetite is huge. Means it can just provide the virtual machine as it is. It doesn't care, because ultimately customer have to make sure that they are putting the real secure application on top of that. They are having all the authentication process or all the standards in place. As a cloud service provider, they are not really caring about all those sort of things. So risk appetite, or risk, I should say, the risk management for the cloud service provider is quite limited. While if it's a SaaS application, or even if it's a PaaS application, the role or the provider's responsibilities, they increase as well. So it all depends on what kind of infrastructure or what kind of service cloud service provider is providing to the end users. And just like the type of service model, the type of data which is stored onto the application, and who owns that data and who is custodian of data, that data also create a big difference in terms of like who will be managing the information, or who need to plan all the risk associated control planning and everything. So it also changes, and it differs who is owning the data and who owns the information and who is the custodian of the data. But before going into that, we need to make sure that we know clearly what is the difference between a data owner, a controller, a custodian, and a data processor, because that is clearly highlighted as one of the key knowledge you should have if you are going for a cloud security exam. As a data owner, you have legal rights and complete control of your data. So if there is a data, if there are some files, if you have the legal rights to own and have complete control over that, then you are the data owner. Now, data owner and data controllers can be same, or can be someone completely different person as well, or can be someone like a completely different department or something in an organization. Controller actually defines the purpose and manner with which the data is processed. So they are not owning the data. They don't have legal rights to own the data or control the data, but they can define the purpose of the data. And they can also decide or define how it should be processed. So for example, if you have a customer's information, then customer is of course having the legal rights of that data. So they are the data owner. But you as a data owner is providing that information or your personal information or your data to maybe, for example, a health service provider. You are legally giving it to them as signing a contract that you can process my data, you can use it as the way you want. So that health service provider can process the data and can use it as per their need. So they become the data controllers. Now we have another term, which is data custodians. Now data custodians are the parties who are responsible for save custody, transport, and storage of the data. Now, in terms of the example which I just now mentioned, like a data owner or someone who is having a health service information, they are sending this data to a health service provider. So health service provider is a controller. Now, how that information is transferred from customer to the health service provider? Maybe they are owning a cloud service provider, or they decided to host an application which is responsible for someone uploading their files or someone uploading their health related reports and x-rays and everything onto the health service provider's portal. Now that application will become kind of like a data custodian, because whoever owns that application, they have to make sure that data is always safe. It is transferred as securely as it can be from customer to the health service provider, so that application owner or the whoever is like getting paid for hosting that application, whoever is selling that application as its business, they also have the responsibility as a data custodian. Because if something goes wrong, if their data got leaked, means you as an application will be the first one who have to bear all the cost associated with it, or all the legal compliance related faults and penalties will be on your ownership first. Closure to custodian, someone can work, means custodian can hire third parties as well to work on behalf of themselves. So for example, maybe someone is having an application and someone created this nice application where any user can upload their files and their information. Now that application owner can use help from some third parties to upload the data, or maybe create a nice front end on which the application is hosted, or maybe some other entities around that application which is actually responsible in somehow from this information flow from point A to point B. Those third parties are actually data processors. So they work closely with the data custodians, and of course they have their own maybe entity or their own legal agreement as well, like how information is transferred. Now we are talking so much about the risk and what kind of risk is associated, but how exactly you can define a risk? If I'm saying that I have a risk of, say, having a heart attack, what is that? What it really is, means who defines that, or what level of that risk is, or is it really something which we should be care about, or is it something which you can ignore, or this is something which is happening right now? Or if you are having a risk of getting robbed because you are living in a neighborhood where they are strangers and you don't know anyone, and there are maybe complaints around the like stolen items and robberies and everything, what level of security you want to put in? Is this risk really big, or is it like really people might be breaking into your house, or is it like a small theft robbery where you, if you go out without taking due diligence, maybe someone can rob you? So risk can have like n number of limitation, and if you're saying that I have risk for something, or I'm feeling that I have risk for x thing, then there must be some level of limit, right? There must be some level of appetite or some level of tolerance you have to put, because anyone cannot be held like full 100% I have risk of something and this is it, I mean this is the end of life. That's not how it works. And something similar happened with enterprise risk management as well. It means every organization, they have risk of getting attacked from malicious or malwares or someone like, even in terms of countries as well, every country, they always say, or every government, they always say that we are at risk of getting cyber attack from a different organization or a different country. But is it like you will be completely blown apart if something goes wrong, or what level of risk you are talking about here? That actually defines the risk profile. So when I talk about risk of something, I need to make sure that I define that risk, and I need to define that risk in terms of risk profile. So we have to define that risk profile. Risk profile will cover like if something goes wrong, what level of financial or reputational loss I will be bearing because of that malicious attack. If someone tries to attack me, or if someone tries to rob me with my data or with my information, is it like I'll be losing everything right there and then itself, or can I have some level of appetite or some level of tolerance around that okay, I know we are cyber attack, but this 20% level of information, if we lose, we don't care about it because they might not be that relevant, so we are fine with that 20%. But anything beyond 20% is something we cannot tolerate, or something which we have to take really seriously. So that actually defined the whole risk profile. Now, in terms of risk profile, we have further segregation, the same terms which I used just now: risk appetite and risk tolerance. Now, any organization's limit to take the risk in the market is covered by appetite. So appetite is kind of like a broader segregation. So for example, any organization can tell you, like, if our application goes down because of a cyber attack, a 1 or 2 hour delay in bringing that up won't impact anything. So we know that there's a risk with the application, and we know there's a risk associated with 2 hours of downtime. We won't be having any legal obligations, or we don't have any legal obligations with the end users to keep that application up and running. We won't be facing any financial loss because of that 2 hour downtime. But anything beyond 2 hours is something which we cannot tolerate, or which we cannot have appetite for. So toleration is a wrong word, which we don't have appetite for. So that's risk appetite. Risk tolerance is something more granular. So just now I mentioned like 2 hours of downtime. During that 2 hour, what level of data loss you can bear, or if that goes beyond 2 hours, what other information or what other application or processes associated with that downtime you might start losing as the risk goes on and on. So risk tolerance is more granular. It goes really into deep details, like what is your organization's limit of risk. And when you go into those granular details, that is something which is more categorized as risk tolerance. So risk appetite and risk tolerance both create any organization's risk profile. And it's really important in terms of a cloud security. Before planning your cloud security, you have to understand what level of risk your organization can bear. And sometimes it's even public as well. Publicly, some organizations, they announce or they have it kind of like broadcasted everywhere that if something goes wrong, we can bear this much loss, but anything beyond that is something we have to like start bringing the big guns in. So that's the risk profile associated with any organization. They all have it. Now here I was talking risk profile or risk appetite and risk tolerance in terms of something goes wrong. What if any organization want to innovate? Now, innovation or change comes with its own risk as well. If you are releasing a new application, or if you are releasing an update in your existing application, maybe something can go wrong, right? Maybe the end users don't like it, or maybe the services which were running absolutely fine in the older version suddenly start breaking when the new release is there in the market. The risk appetite around that new release or the new information or new update you sent in also defines how much innovation you can do. Normally in any organization, or normally in the market as well, any company or any group of people or any new startup or any new organization, they all tend to have higher risk appetite, because that's how they work. They will announce like, we are innovating new things, we are building new stuff every day, we are trying to make our end users or users of our application, user of our information, user of our software. We want to give something new to them. We want to give something exciting to them every day or every week. And that's why we are continuously releasing the new updates. If something goes wrong, if something breaks due to that, we are still fine with it because we have a higher risk appetite, or we can tolerate that higher downtime. We don't care about that. Or even if we care, means it's not like no one cares. But even if it breaks, they have confidence that they can resolve it, or they can roll back to the older version right away. So innovation, of course, require a higher risk appetite. Those stable organizations which treat that they have low risk appetite, they can't even afford a single second of downtime in their application, they tend to stay, like, maintain the status quo. They don't tend to innovate as much as the one who have the risk appetite. So risk profile of any organization also drives the business to move forward. Now, there is a slight difference between appetite and toleration again. Higher appetite doesn't mean that you have higher tolerance as well. For example, if you are hungry and you have like appetite of eating something right away, with means you're really hungry, maybe you're hungry for 3 or 4 days, and you feel like, I have appetite of eating for 3 people, I can eat like 3 people worth of food right away because I am really hungry for that, I have a big appetite, doesn't mean that you are losing the toleration. Means if you have allergy to a specific food, if you have higher appetite, doesn't mean that you can even eat that food with which you are allergic as well. So your toleration doesn't really be associated with your appetite as well. A higher appetite still can have that same level of toleration which you always have. So it doesn't mean that if you have higher risk appetite as an organization, that means you can just tolerate any kind of risks. If you think from point of view from a market or technical terms, if in the same example, if you are innovating and if you are releasing the new application every or new release or new software every week, if something goes wrong in that application, you're okay to roll it back. You have a bigger appetite of application going down. That's absolutely fine. But maybe there are some key customers who are using that application, and for those customers, even a single second downtime is a big thing. So you still have to maintain that toleration. You still have to make sure that release the new application into the, have this kind of like partial rolling updates where only some users who are those non-critical users, they are receiving the updates, and only once it's tested fine and end users are not having any complaints, then you go for a major full-fledged level of rollout to everyone else who are like your key customers who can't have toleration of even of a single second downtime. So your risk toleration and risk appetite are completely different things, and a higher appetite drives innovation doesn't mean that you can have higher risk tolerance as well. Now, one more topic which I have covered before as well, but it's coming again, so I will go in deep into that, is how you calculate the risk metrics or how a risk is actually calculated in terms of what's higher risk and what's lower risk. So remember, we had discussed about impact and likelihood. So if there is a high impact and high likelihood scenario, that of course can be associated with high risk. But if something is really highly impacting but likelihood is very less, for example, flood in your, if you are living in an area which is not prone to flood, so it's extremely unlikely. But if flood comes, means although it's completely unlikely, if it comes, your whole data center will be gone. Impact is big, but likelihood is less, so it will be lesser than, of course, high risk events. Similarly, if something is really likely but impact is low, you also won't care about those. For example, there is likelihood of new rolling updates every now and then in your application, but you know that impact will be less because those rolling updates will be tested in the dev environment, and before rolled out in production, they will be having all level of QA tested and absolutely fine. You can treat it as a low impact because everyone know what will be impact of that application. It's completely tested within the staging and dev environment. You can treat it as a low risk again compared to the high risk event. So these are the two criteria based on which we create a matrix around the risk and how we can segregate between a high risk event and low risk event. Now, whenever we talk about risk or whenever we talk about, in fact, anything, especially in domain 6, we always get these kind of like frameworks and standards associated with it. So with risk as well, we have three main frameworks which is talked in CCSP course. One of them is ISO 31000-2009, which is a standard framework which assists in helping in setting up the guidelines and processes of for any organization in identifying and assessing and managing the risks. Another one is ENISA, which is Europe Network and InfoSec Agency, which do the same thing. So it creates the set of guidelines and processes for identifying, assessing, and managing the risk. And NIST is always there. So NIST is National Institute of Standard and Technology, which again create the set of guidelines and processes. So these three organizations, they provide the frameworks around the risk management. So you don't have to reinvent the wheel. You don't have to put in your effort in defining something from scratch. Use the framework provided by these organizations and it will work absolutely fine. Now that is all around the cloud enterprise risk management. Let's move to contracting. Now, contracts are the legal binding documents which two parties sign. Means we all sign contracts when we move our houses or we buy a car or we even get a credit card or something. So contract is always there. Same goes for cloud service provider and someone who is buying the cloud services, an end user or even third parties. Contract plays a big role in defining who is owning what part of the infrastructure, who will be responsible for providing what level of services, and who will be taking care of if something goes wrong or if there is a legal obligation to provide some information or provide some reports, who will be providing what part of that. So all information is covered in as part of contract. Once a contract is written, there is another set of agreement which is service level agreement, decided and signed and agreed between all the parties involved. So someone who is selling the services, for example, a cloud service provider, they will tell the end user or they will confirm the end user that we will be giving you availability of 99.999%. So they treat it in terms of number of nines. Or so 5 nines or 4 nines or 99.999, something like that. This is all part of SLA. So service level agreement, they help determining the quality of service. So if you are a cloud service provider and someone have bought the services from you with 99.9% availability or even 99% availability, so you're not obliged to provide them full 99.99% availability, because this is not what you're getting paid for. Same way for end users, if they have bought like a full-fledged agreement of 99.999% and your application goes down, then you can impose penalty on the cloud service provider and they have to pay you back. So it works both ways, and it normally includes, not limited to, availability, performance, location, what level of encryption is used, what is the uptime of your application. There are a lot of metrics and a lot of KPIs based on which you charge, and you create this SLA graph and you start charging your end users or your cloud service provider. With the reports, you can compare easily, like if your SLA is breached or not. Now, when we create a contract, it not only covers the SLA, it also covers other bits as well, like right to audit. Means if there is an organization which bought a PCI DSS compliant application from an application service provider or a cloud service provider, the end user or the data owners or whoever bought that application, they can go and ask anytime with the cloud service provider and application service provider about the audit report, like if they are PCI DSS compliant really, or if they are following all the standards or the requirement to make environment compliant, who is using that, who have access to that application. It's completely legal. It is the right of that application user that they can ask and they can get those reports, and no one can refuse it. So it's a right to audit your environment if you're buying something from a service provider. Same goes with the termination as well. You need to clearly define till when you want this particular application or till when you want a cloud service account or what level of and if you, for example, terminate your contract, what will happen to your data which you have stored in the cloud? Who will be deleting it? Is it your responsibility or it's the responsibility of application provider who held your data when it was with them? So it again ties to the same discussion we had just now around the data owner and data custodian, because if you as an end user tell that, okay, that's fine, I don't want to keep you guys my data, or as a data controller, if you are managing and processing data on behalf of someone and suddenly you realize that the data custodian which I hired or the application which I got contract to help in uploading and reaching the data from end users to me, I don't like that application, I want to move from that application to someone else, or even I don't want to move my AWS cloud service provider, I don't want to keep that, I want to move to Azure now. Legally, I can ask them that terminate everything, delete all my data and don't keep anything with you, don't archive anything, and of course show me proof as well that you have deleted all the data which I gave to you. So it's all again part of the contract, and that's why the contract which is written between different service providers and the users is very important and should be read and made by the experts. Because it controls everything. It have everything what will happen to you and your information. Another complexity which is happening these days is around the vendors. Cloud is an old technology now, means it's been here for more than a decade. We have a lot of players who are providing the cloud service providers. Even there are new companies as well. Just last week, I got a call from someone from a different company. They are the new startup which are providing the cloud services, and they wanted me to move my organizations, or at least convince my organization to move workload from AWS and Azure to that new organization. So they are new vendors as well. It's not like AWS, Azure, GCP, that's it. Means Oracle is a big name, which is a fourth big cloud service provider. So there are a lot of vendors. And if you are tied to a single vendor, good luck, means you are kind of like in a lock-in situation. You might be tied to them, you might be getting a good discounted services, but again you are not really using the cloud. I am a big supporter of multi-cloud technologies. It make your system, it make you, your as an end user, your whole design really complicated, but it's a great way to learn different clouds, and it's a great way to take services and take the best options from each cloud. So never ever tie yourself with a single cloud. But of course, there's a complexity associated as well. You now have to manage contract with different cloud service providers. So vendor management is a big thing now, and how you are creating the contracts, how you are maintaining the SLAs, how you are ensuring your applications in different vendors or different cloud service provider is running absolutely fine, what kind of usage you are using, what kind of best practices you are employing while you deploy those application between the two cloud service provider. It's all covered as part of vendor management. And of course, each vendor will try to lure you to use absolutely their services. Just like I mentioned, the scenario where they want you to lock yourself in into their cloud services. So vendor management is a big topic as well, which we have to understand and which we have to think before we really go deep into cloud security. How many different vendors are there in the market? What will be your approach if there is a new vendor or if there is a new cloud service provider or a new app service provider? What you need to check from their side, like what kind of services they are providing? Are they legally owned or they are legally to do business with you? Maybe they are not tied to an organization which or a country or an entity which is not a legitimate owner or something. So vendor management is a key thing as well from the cloud service or cloud security point of view. Something similar is with supply chain management as well. If you are deploying your application, but you are not aware of the source of the application, what kind of processes are used, what kind of softwares are used as part of building that application, it kind of places you in a tricky situation, because if something goes wrong, who should you blame? You cannot blame the application provider because you have legally signed a contract with them and you have told them that, okay, we are fine with your application, but maybe it's not running a good source control, or they are not running an updated known vulnerable sub-process as part of their application build process. Supply chain management is really tricky business now, especially in terms of containerized system, because containerized application are new. They are, if I be blunt here, they are pretty rare to be stable, because of course we have stable version of each containerized app. But once an application is tested absolutely fine and it's working fine in production, there are less and less chance that people update all the subcomponents of that containerized app, because it might break. And to be honest, means ultimately what you want is your application to work absolutely fine and don't break just because someone recommended that you have to update a minor Python version or a minor Java version, which is just a part of your application. As a developer or as an application provider, you will think that it doesn't make sense to break application because you want to update everything. But as a user or as a cloud security person, you need to make sure that everything is patched, or at least you have a list of application or processes which is deployed or which are used to build the whole code. So supply chain management actually covers everything, and things are getting better, means we have different solutions which can actually detect and define and give you a nice list of all the subcomponents which are created as part of that application. But it's only a matter of, like, if you are really using those solutions. So it makes sense to get hands dirty on those aspects as well and get yourself comfortable with different components of the application and which component is doing what and what its role is, what kind of version it's using. It's not using a vulnerable code or something. So that's part of supply chain management. All right, that's it for today's episode. I hope I have covered everything. If still something you feel like something might be missed, then we can of course go through the whole syllabus. But as of now, means I told you in the start of episode that I have registered for the exam. So I will be going deep into that phase where I'll be doing more of reading and more of learning myself before going for the exam. Anything new comes up in between those days, like before December, then of course I will let you guys know. I'll make an episode. If there's nothing new, then probably I'll make an episode around what's going on with the day-to-day news around cloud security, because that was my plan, that once CCSP is over, we can switch into those discussions or those information sharing around any new security incident or anything new around the security which I can share with you guys. So either way, means I will be active on the channel and I will be keep on sharing the new information and new data. If you have planned your cloud exam already, if you are already going for CCSP, then of course good luck for that. And if you are still unclear, if you still want to take more time, then that's absolutely fine, because we have to go with our own pace. Anyways, thanks for listening to today's episode. This is last episode for CCSP, like I mentioned, and when we will be coming back with something new, like some new certifications, then of course you will be the first to know. Maybe the banner of the channel or banner of the podcast will change, because right now it's only having CompTIA and CCSP, so maybe something else will be added there. But till then, goodbye and good luck.
Thank you for listening to Get Certified Together. If you loved our content, then please like and subscribe from your favorite podcast platform so you don't miss the notification for our next episodes and announcements.
How do you feel when you switch to GEICO and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today is actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with GEICO feels just like that. Get more with GEICO.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.